Next, we'll talk about people who play an outsized role in our economy, in our politics, even in our culture. We live in a country where we pay a lot of attention to the wealthy, yet even as we pay attention, we don't necessarily get a good look at them. Journalist Chrystia Freeland has been trying to do that. She's been talking with some of the super rich. Many of the characters in her new book, Plutocrats, are people, mostly men, who made their fortunes rather than inheriting them.
These super rich are people who, as they like to say, did it themselves. And what's interesting for me, and actually I didn't expect it, I think it's a paradox of this sort of working super rich, which is you would think, or I would think, that having done it yourself, you might have more sympathy, be closer to the 99%, or, you know, as Mitt Romney has called them, the 47%. But I think in many ways, that personal history of really feeling like I did this by myself actually creates more of a chasm between them and the rest of us, and I would say a certain degree of disdain.
So if you feel you have dragged yourself up to the pinnacle, you feel very strongly that other people ought to be supporting themselves too. Is that what you're saying?
Well, that's certainly the attitude that I encountered. You know, the people at the very, very top, when you talk to them about especially the U.S. middle class, what I heard a lot was, well, you know, one hedge fund guy from Connecticut said to me, the low-paid American worker is the most overpaid worker in the world. Another guy who's the CFO of a technology company on the West Coast, he said to me, you know what? They want to live 10 times better than the Chinese. They need to be 10 times more productive.
Hmm.
And if they're not, they have to take a pay cut.
And his background there is that he's working 18 hours a day, so he doesn't see why other people shouldn't just work harder? Is that what you're saying?
Yes, and I think it's not just the question of work harder, but it is a sense of, you know, I deserve this. And yes, I do think that there is, you know, both a very powerful sense of entitlement and a kind of a bubble of wealth which makes it hard for people at the very top to understand the travails of the middle class. One of the sort of moments that really was jaw-dropping for me was talking to one billionaire, and he was speaking with real sympathy about friends of friends who had come to him for some financial advice on their investing. And he said to me, and you know what? They only had $10 million saved.
Mm.
How are they going to live on that? He was really worried about how you get by in your retirement if you have a mere $10 million in the bank.
Okay, so you're suggesting the really rich are out of touch with most of America. But let me ask about a couple of nuances on that. Some of the things that you've said seem to imply that the really rich are politically conservative. But aren't there an awful lot of rich people who end up being politically liberal? I mean, Warren Buffett voted for Barack Obama, if I'm not mistaken.
Absolutely. You can definitely find plutocrats across the political spectrum. It is, however, also the case that in the United States, there has been a real shift away from Barack Obama, and a lot of these guys loved him in 2008. They saw him as one of us, right? He was a self-made guy, and they feel really angry at Obama. And it's not just about the question of taxes, although that angers them a lot. And it's kind of amazing how far someone who has hundreds of millions of dollars will go to get a couple of percentage points knocked off his taxes. But it's also a profound emotional thing. And what I think is going on is in America, we have equated personal business success with public virtue. And to a certain extent, your moral and civic virtue could be measured by the size of your bank account. And what I think has entered the political discourse now, and I think the president has been one of the people pushing this, is he's saying, wait a minute, what is good for the guys at the very top is not necessarily good for the people in the middle.
And you're telling me that very wealthy people that you have spoken with are personally offended by this?
I think it's even more than personally offended. I think that it's actually an existential threat. People don't just want to be rich and successful. They want to be good. And I think it's really threatening to feel like, wow, you mean I'm not as full of virtue and goodness as I thought I was?
So how are these super rich, whom you have interviewed, different from the super rich of 1955, say?
Well, first of all, there's a lot more of them. And the gap between them and us is much, much greater. One of the things which is really astonishing is how much bigger the gap is than it was before. In the 1950s, America was relatively egalitarian, much more so than compared to now. The gap between how much the CEO earned and how much his workers earned has just risen exponentially. That is the single biggest difference. The other difference is that nowadays, the super rich are global. That is something which is imposed on them by the nature of the world economy. And so increasingly, I think you are actually, you know, seeing what ironically was the dream of Marxists, right? You are seeing the emergence of an international class.
Excuse me, the dream of Marxists to have billionaires?
No, no, but the dream of Marxists was this notion of the nation state dissolving.
Withering away.
And this notion that borders wouldn't matter, that we would have commonality of interests around the world. Well, guess who got there first? The plutocrats.
Okay, so what are the long-term implications of having a really, really rich elite that, in your view, is less and less connected to the country?
My long-term fear is that even if you rose to the top thanks to a society that was very open, that had a lot of social mobility, as America did in the past, the inevitable human temptation once you get to the top is to rig the rules of the game in your own favor. And you don't do this in a kind of chortling, smoking your cigar, conspiratorial thinking way. You do it by persuading yourself that what is in your own personal self-interest is in the interests of everybody else. So you persuade yourself that actually government services, things like spending on education, which is what created that social mobility in the first place, need to be cut so that the budget deficit can shrink, so that your tax bill doesn't go up. And what I really worry about is there is so much money and so much power at the very top, and the gap between those people at the very top and everybody else is so great that we are going to see social mobility choked off and society transformed.
Chrystia Freeland interviewed wealthy people for the book Plutocrats, The Rise of the New Global Super Rich and the Fall of Everyone Else. Okay, this is an anniversary I can get into, Renee. 60 years ago today, Charlotte's Web first appeared in print, one of the biggest selling and best loved children's books of all time.
And my favorite childhood book, actually, so I can too. Most readers would describe it as the classic tale of an unlikely friendship between a spider and a pig, and how by weaving words above his pen, the spider transforms the pig's life.
But when E.B. White recorded his own narration of this book in 1970, he said this.
This is a story of the barn. I wrote it for children and to amuse myself.
Story of the barn. And Homer Zuckerman's big old barn is where everything unfolds. It's where Wilbur the pig finds a home, where he meets Charlotte the spider.
It smelled of hay, and it smelled of manure. It smelled of the perspiration of tired horses and the wonderful sweet breath of patient cows. It often had a sort of peaceful smell, as though nothing bad could happen ever again in the world.
E.B. White would have been familiar with those smells. He grew up in a New York City suburb at a time when people rode horses and carriages. His parents had a stable.
And his favorite thing was to care for animals, chickens, ducks, mice.
That's Michael Sims, who wrote a book called The Story of Charlotte's Web.
And then in 1933, he and his wife, Catherine Angel, moved to Maine, bought a farm, and settled into a whole different kind of life that brought back all of the favorite joys of childhood.
Mr. Zuckerman had the best swing in the county. It was a single long piece of heavy rope tied to the beam over the north doorway. At the bottom end of the rope was a fat knot to sit on. It was arranged so that you could swing without being pushed.
You climbed a ladder to the hayloft. Then, holding the rope, you stood at the edge and looked down. And you were scared and dizzy. Then you straddled the knot so that it acted as a seat. And you got up all your nerve, took a deep breath, and jumped.
E.B. White started reading that passage. I think I'd never heard his voice before. And we also heard a 10-year-old from Washington, D.C. reading there.
And as an adult in his own barn, E.B. White encountered the animals and experiences that would lead him to Charlotte's Web.
One of the pigs he was raising died. And while he was carrying the pails of slops every day to the replacement pig in the barn, he noticed that there was a spider attending its web every day, expanding the web, rebuilding what had happened the night before. And then one day he saw that it had spun an egg case, and so he stopped to examine it.
Okay, spoiler alert here. We're about to give away the ending, so if you don't want to hear it, just take a second, turn down the radio for a few seconds, come back to us in a minute.
To many readers, Charlotte's death at the end of the book is heartbreaking, but perhaps no one was more heartbroken than the author himself.
When E.B. White was doing the narration, he, of course, as anyone does when doing an audiobook, had to do several takes for various things just to get it right. But every time, he broke down when he got to Charlotte's death. And he would do it, and it would mess up, and they would say, okay, let's take a break and start over. And he did that again until he took 17 takes to get through Charlotte's death without his voice cracking or beginning to cry.
The fairgrounds were soon deserted. The sheds and buildings were empty and forlorn. The infield was littered with bottles and trash. Nobody of the hundreds of people that had visited the fair knew that a gray spider had played the most important part of all. No one was with her when she died.
That was E.B. White reading from his classic children's tale, Charlotte's Web, published 60 years ago today. And our young reader in this story was Eleanor Holt of Washington, D.C.
People who host NPR shows are often credited or accused of being knowledgeable. Actually, all we know how to do is to punch in an extension. To get?
Library, it's Key.
Key, can I please have the names and contact numbers for every left-handed plumber in Kuala Lumpur?
No.
Oh, that's Key Molesky, the longest-serving member of a stellar company of NPR reference librarians who check, double-check, and mine miles of information, urban legend, and spin for cold, hard, glittering facts. Key's also the author of the Oscar-winning book, All Facts Considered. Check that, please, won't you, Key? Her new book, Learn Something New Every Day, 365 Facts to Fulfill Your Life. Let's slip into the studio. Key, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
This book gives readers something that they can learn every day. So let's begin with today's date, okay? October 13th. What do Woolworths and the U.S. Supreme Court have in common?
Well, you mean the Woolworth building in New York City and the Supreme Court building here in Washington were both designed by the same architect, Cass Gilbert. But, of course, Cass Gilbert is a 19th century architect, and the Supreme Court's been around a lot longer than that. But I call this fact wandering SCOTUS, because they didn't have a home until on this date in 1932, when the cornerstone was laid for the building we know as the Supreme Court. When the government came to Washington, D.C., they had some rooms in the Capitol. Mm-hmm. Then, of course, the Capitol was burned by the British in the War of 1812.
Oh, right. Yeah.
But it was actually former President William Howard Taft, who had become Supreme Court Chief Justice, who finally persuaded Congress that the Supreme Court ought to have its own building.
Okay, March 2nd, on that date in 1959. Well, all right, let's cue the music. Miles Davis, Kind of Blue.
Kind of Blue.
Help us appreciate this recording.
Well, March 2nd, 1959, Miles Davis called a bunch of musicians into a studio in New York. Bill Evans, Wynton Kelly, Jimmy Cobb, Cannonball Adderley, John Coltrane. And the idea was to try something completely different. He didn't give them charts. He just gave them ideas, outlines of what the tunes mm-hmm. would be. They did only one take for each of the songs. And it was an experiment with modal jazz, which was different from the more prevalent and popular types of jazz at the time.
The date, July 20.
That's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
Of course, the world just said about Neil Armstrong, and many stories were told of the moment that he piloted the Eagle onto the surface of the moon. When they lifted off the next day, what did Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin leave behind on the surface of the moon?
Well, they had brought up a few mementos that they wanted to leave there. It was a gold olive branch to signify mm-hmm. peace, a patch from the Apollo 1 flight to honor the three astronauts who had died in the fire on the launch pad in 1967, and two medals from the Soviet Union commemorating Yuri Gagarin, the first man in space, and Vladimir Komarov, who had died in reentry of his Soyuz 1 capsule.
Finally, September 20th, okay, if Martians were to hear our interview, and they decided to come here and they found you and say, Key, finally, someone who can answer all of our questions, how many species live on your, how do you call it, Earth? What would you say?
We would have to say that we don't really know, because there's millions of them and nobody's been able to sit down and count them all. But last year, a group of scientists came up with a pretty good estimate, approximately 8.7 million species, not counting bacteria and viruses. Most of those are not yet described and analyzed, and they did it by a mathematical formula, as I say, not by going out
and counting
8.7. But they feel that's a pretty good estimate.
And of that number, how many cast votes on Dancing with the Stars?
I think all 7.7 million animals, 298,000 plants, 611,000 fungi, and, you know, a bunch of protozoa.
Key Maleski, NPR's longest-serving librarian and author of the new book, Learn Something New Every Day, 365 Facts to Fulfill Your Life.
Plus a bonus fact for leap year.
You're not going to tell us that one, are you?
It's about leap year.
Hey, that's Miles. And this is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Melissa Block, and here beside me in the studio is a large bowl filled with creamy, pale hummus, the Middle Eastern chickpea spread. I made the hummus using a recipe from a new cookbook called Jerusalem. And the authors say they're taking a giant leap of faith to claim that hummus will eventually bring Jerusalemites together if nothing else will. And they should know. Chef Yotam Ottolenghi is a Jew from the west side of Jerusalem. His friend, fellow chef, and business partner, Sami Tamimi, is a Palestinian who grew up in Muslim East Jerusalem. They work together at the popular Ottolenghi restaurants in London and join me to talk about the food and culture of their birthplace. Yotam and Sami, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Hello.
And why do we start with hummus, this bowl of hummus that I have sitting next to me? In your cookbook, you call hummus an obsession, an explosive subject in Jerusalem. Why is that, Yotam?
Well, hummus is everybody's favorite food in Jerusalem. And when you talk about something that is so common to everybody else, but in a place that is so sort of highly divided in many ways, then it is already a formula for an explosion, because everybody wants to take ownership over that plate of hummus, both Jews and Arabs. And when this argument starts, you know, there's no end to it.
And Sami, it looks so benign sitting here next to me. It's hard to believe it would be that divisive.
Exactly.
You both left Jerusalem many, many years ago, and I was wondering if you could think back to a smell memory or maybe a taste memory from your childhood that for you really captures that city. Sami, do you want to start?
There are quite a lot of things. I mean, just walking down to the market and you get here and there different things like figs or coffee with cardamom, sweets, kind of aromas and colors, and it's just,
you know, kind of Sami, when we were talking about food memories, and during the process of writing the book, Sami and I discovered quite a few times about certain memories that we really share. And it's funny because we lived in really the two opposite sides of the city, or the two very unmixing sides of the city, the Arab and the Jewish parts. And I remember when I rewrote the chapter about falafel, Sami started telling me his version of it. You know, when school ends, you go home, and then on the way back, there is the falafel stall. You know, falafel is almost as popular as hummus. And, you know, you shouldn't buy yourself a falafel in a pita, because, you know, you're going to have lunch served to you by your mother in 5 minutes, but you really, really must have it. And then you arrive back home, you're so full, the shirt is covered with tahini sauce that's been dripping all over you, and there's this sort of And we literally had exactly the same experience, you know, the angry mother, falafel full, you can't eat. The whole thing is so similar in many ways. And, you know, we were really living in two separate cultures.
How do you think the approach to food, or maybe the emotion behind food, is different in Jerusalem than it is there in London where you live now, or maybe other cities where you've lived or traveled?
There is something about Jerusalem is quite special like this, because there's a lot of interaction between the cuisines. Jews came from all over, and the Arabs that were living in Jerusalem for generations have been cooking a certain kind of food. And as soon as the Jews started arriving, there is this sort of mixture and reciprocal influences started happening. So you get those sort of cross hybrids, like something that a Tunisian Jewish woman would cook that is very much influenced by what a Palestinian Arab woman would cook next door or in the next neighborhood. And you've got these funny mixes that are really just typical for Jerusalem. And to every recipe, there's always attached a personal story.
With that mixture of cultures that you're talking about in Jerusalem come battles over the ownership of food, right? We were talking about this earlier. Deep divisions over which culture can stake a claim to what food.
Yeah, I mean, what we sort of found out over the period we were working on the book is that it's so easy to get into a row over, you know, who invented hummus and why and at which stage. And it's very difficult to find the answer to these things, because you can always look a little bit further down history and find someone else that cooked that same dish before you. I mean, especially if it's something as simple as crushed chickpeas. And so there's these arguments about ownership, but then there's also arguments that are actually, I find, a little bit more fruitful, and that's about who makes the best hummus in town, you know, which restaurants makes the best hummus in.
They also analyze it. I mean, things like hummus, what kind of chickpeas, what time of the night they soak the chickpeas.
What temperature you eat it in, the exact temperature.
It just goes on and on. You know, for us, we didn't really want to go this path.
I think what we were really interesting is just choose the best recipe that we could put our hands on. And this was the funnest bit, that we didn't feel that we had to reflect any one community or one kind of tradition. We could really mold them to fit us.
The cliche here would be that food becomes the thing that breaks down boundaries, right? That people gather around the table and all those divisions melt away. In Jerusalem, would that be overstating the fact? Is that a way simplistic explanation of what might happen?
Yeah.
As much as you might want hummus to bring people together, it's obviously more complicated than that.
It is much more complicated than that. What we say in the book, and I think it's, we're trying to be quite cautious because, you know, Sami and I are working together in London and not in Jerusalem, and I think that's quite a telling fact. It's very difficult to be completely optimistic or to put gloss on this picture. We say, okay, if everybody around a big table, we could solve all the problems, because at the moment we can't, unfortunately, and this really doesn't happen. And this is not a good time for the Palestinian-Israeli conflict at all. But what we did say, and I think this is quite evident from going around Jerusalem, is that the only places that people do interact and do meet to a degree is when we are related to food. You know, it's in markets when they go shopping, and in restaurants where occasionally people sit side by side and eat, or in restaurant kitchens where they cook together. And in that respect, there is much more in common than you think, than you give credit. There's much, people have more in common, Jews and Arabs, in Jerusalem. So it's a hypothetical statement that we give at one point, saying if there was a way to solve the problem, if there was a way to bring people closer together, it would be around food, around a plate of hummus and nothing else.
Sammy?
I don't think I can add to that.
Before I let you go, I need a little advice with this hummus, which is sitting next to me and smelling very garlicky. It's very dense and thick. It's not as creamy as I remember it should be. And it's very tahini-ish.
Yeah,
this is
how
we
like
it. We said in unison.
It's fine. And just add a little bit of water and kind of whisk it really well.
Okay, so just some water. Good. Yeah. Good to know. Yotam Ottolenghi and Sammy Tamimi, they're partners in the Ottolenghi restaurant in London, and their new cookbook is Jerusalem. Thanks so much to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And you can find recipes from their Jerusalem cookbook and see photos of the city's markets and street food on NPR's food blog, The Salt. That's at npr.org. You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. While much of America was watching the second presidential debate last night, about 2,000 people were doing something very different. They had gotten a rare and prized ticket to the only appearance of J.K. Rowling in the United States as she promotes her new book for adults, The Casual Vacancy. NPR's Margo Adler was there.
It was one of the happiest groups of people I have ever seen in New York City, double the number originally planned. They had to change theaters. For some $40, you got a ticket to the Lincoln Center event, and you got a copy of the book, which she would later sign for you under very rigorous rules. 2 hours before the event, P.J. Clark's, a noted before theater restaurant across the street, was filled with fans of Rowling and Harry Potter. There were tables of 10 and 12 scattered about, reunions of people from all over the states.
The two most significant things I've done since college have been being in romantic relationships for the first time and reading Harry Potter.
Andrew Slack is in his 30s, and he runs the Harry Potter Alliance that does activism out of Harry Potter. They sent 5 cargo planes to Haiti, he says, founded libraries in parts of the world. Harry Potter not only shaped his life, it shaped his career.
Now I do Harry Potter for a living. So yes, it's been my full-time job since 2007.
The people at this table were from Boston, Washington, D.C., Arkansas, and Ohio. I asked Melissa Lawson, a high school librarian from Chillicothe, Ohio, if she liked The Casual Vacancy.
It was so different from anything that she'd written before, but it was so interesting to see her voice applied to a very different style of narrative, see the same social issues that you can pick out in Harry Potter, slated to an adult audience. I loved it.
So I'm going to guess that this is a bunch of J.K. Rowling Harry Potter fans, if I ever saw any.
Yeah. Outside the theater, other groups of friends gathered. Rosie Diaz from Florida said she hadn't traveled the farthest.
There's a girl from Paris, yeah.
Wait. You came from Paris?
Yeah.
To come here?
Yeah.
Margo Herrera is from Florida, actually. She's studying in Paris and flew in for this. She also loves the new book, but Harry Potter is what brought her here.
They remind me of my childhood the way music reminds you of things when you're younger. The reason we cling to these books isn't because they were fun and we grew up with them. We cling to them because of deeper themes, because of friendship and because of loyalty and because of human connections.
Inside, when Rowling was introduced, the applause was long and thunderous. The event was not for the press, and they wouldn't allow recording of the interview. Rowling was interviewed by writer Ann Patchett. Patchett now runs an independent bookstore and told Rowling, "You have done more for reading than anyone else in my life." The themes she asked about were totally adult: structure, the difficulty of portraying villains, and both agreed that it would be inappropriate for someone under 14 or 15 to read The Casual Vacancy. Funniest line, Rowling said the difference between her book and 50 Shades of Grey, people have sex in this book, but nobody really enjoys it. After the event, row by row, the audience went to get their copies autographed. The huge line resembled airport security. You even had to hold your ticket out, but no one was peevish. There were smiles and laughter everywhere. As people left the theater, Melissa Anelli, who runs the Harry Potter fan site, The Leaky Cauldron, said, notice something.
Nobody's asking her about Dumbledore or Ron, or, you know, they wanted to know about writing for grown-ups. They wanted to know about the differences in theme, and it's just, that's nice.
This is the generation that grew up with Harry Potter, she says. Now they're adults, and they're ready to take the next step, along with her. Margo Adler, NPR News, New York.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.